turning astray of the path that was left long ago. All we leave behind, time after time, is a legacy with nothing to show. Now our country is lost, and it's not without cost, for there's many who struggle every day. And I think that it's time we start crying for our nation and bow our heads and pray. If today you lost your life, what would you leave behind? What would the ones around you see? What happened in the day?
Hey everyone, this is Steve Donahue with another episode of the Legacy Podcast, helping you build a multi-generational legacy of abundance. This episode is somewhere like 165 or something like that. But anyway, it is going to be from Matthew chapter 5. I'm doing a series right now, of course, on the 50 most important passages of the New Testament, or 50 essential passages of the New Testament, at the church in which I pastor, Mount Tabor Baptist Church. And this is the first of maybe two or three parts from the Sermon on the Mount, which is chapter 5 through 7 of the Gospel of Matthew. And, of course, in the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus is trying to articulate the difference between just an external obedience to the law and an internal obedience to the law, and indicating that everyone falls short of the ultimate standard that God has set for us in His law. And so he goes over that in Matthew chapter 5. So stay tuned for that. If you like the show and you want to support the show, there's all kinds of ways you can do that. You can do that by finding out all the ways. There's a link in the show notes as well as on the right center column of the website. Appreciate all those of you who are doing that in various ways. And without further ado, here you go with Matthew chapter 5.
What is the best sermon that you have ever heard preached? Well, I know that I have had the opportunity to at least read over the sermon of Jonathan Edwards called Sinners in the Hand of an Angry God, which is a classic sermon, probably one of the best ever written. And I have heard replicas of Charles Haddon Spurgeon, who is considered the prince of preaching back in England. I've heard some of his sermons before, and they're phenomenal sermons. Maybe you have a favorite radio preacher that you listen to on a regular basis who can deliver really good sermons, and you've been really blessed by that. And I don't want to mention any television one, because most of those aren't very good, but there are a few on the radio that are pretty good. But none of them compares to the sermon that Jesus delivers here that we read about in Matthew chapter 5, verse 7, or chapter 5 through 7. This must have been an incredible message to be a part of, and to be one of the disciples that gathered around him on that mountain to hear him deliver this message was certainly a great privilege. And this begins one of five different discourses in Matthew. He breaks up his discourses with, he'll have a discourse, and he'll have some activities around that discourse, and then another discourse and some more activities. And this is the first one of the discourses that we find in the Gospel of Matthew. The purpose of this Sermon on the Mount really was to clarify what righteousness is. There was this idea in the first century that you could achieve righteousness by living according to certain standards that the Pharisees had developed. And we'll read more about the Pharisees as we go along, but there was this understanding that if you were like the Pharisees, or certainly if you were a Pharisee yourself, that you could obtain a certain amount of righteousness in this life. And Jesus hard hits them with this message. And so we'll see his method really is to preach humility, or to preach grace to the humble, and to preach the law to the proud. And so we'll see that he intermixes those based upon who he's talking about throughout this. We're going to look at this in maybe two or three parts. The first part today is in chapter 5. And what we find here, first of all, is we find that righteousness and happiness can go together. Righteousness and happiness. Chapter 5, verses 1 through 12, we have what are commonly called the Beatitudes. Some of you have probably raised up learning these or memorizing these. They are certainly worthy of memory. And so I ask the question, what makes us happy? I think if you were to take a survey in the United States and ask what most people would consider to make themselves happy, they would say, well, to have a good job, to have a good family, be able to, you know, make a lot of money, be able to retire at an early age and buy the yacht or maybe travel around, frowning, not like a yacht, but that there's this idea that material possessions bring about happiness in this society. Isn't that kind of what we would think? And yet that's a far cry from what Jesus says actually brings true happiness. And in fact, what we find here is it's not so much even events. It's not even what we might consider family would be a great asset to have, a great thing that would bring a lot of happiness. And indeed, a family does bring a lot of happiness. But the character qualities that Jesus pinpoints here in the Beatitudes go beyond that. And the word happy here, or blessed, it says in the text, carries the idea of fortune or blissful state. In this case, it refers to the deep emotional response resulting from the grace that is given to us by God. And these qualities represent the characters of the true followers of Christ. They are those who are humbled before the Lord. They are not what we would consider the way to be happy, and yet they are the way that Jesus emphasizes. So what are they? First of all, blessed are the poor in spirit. This is the opposite of self-sufficiency. Now, in our culture, we pride ourselves in being self-sufficient, being able to not need anything or anybody. We talk about our rugged individualism and our self-reliance in our country. And yet, that's a far cry, what Jesus says. He says, blessed are those who are poor in spirit. And really, to be poor in spirit means to be of great need. And blessed are those who understand their great need for Jesus. And then in verse 4, it says, blessed are those who mourn. To mourn specifically would mean to mourn over one's sin. And they are, of course, comforted. Why? Because they realize that when they are mourning over their own sin, they are humbled before the Lord, and the Lord is gracious to those who are humble. The third one is meekness. Verse 5, it says, blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Now, meekness is a word that's often misunderstood. Sometimes we consider meekness kind of mousy. Someone who's just kind of wimpy and not able to do much. But meekness is really a great word. A meekness carries the idea of somebody who has incredible strength under control. And so it's somebody who is able to do really whatever he wants, but it controls himself so he does what is right. That's what meekness really is. And of course it says, blessed are those who are meek. Now in our society, we would say, who are those who get ahead in our society? Those who stomp on other people, those who take advantage, right? Unfortunately, that's often the case. But he says that those who are meek who will inherit the earth. And then number 4, which we find in the next verse. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness. This, of course, is the opposite of self-righteousness. Those who are self-righteous see no need to hunger and thirst for righteousness. Why? Because they're righteous in themselves. They don't need to look outside themselves for the righteousness. They're righteous within themselves. But what does Jesus say? He says, blessed are those who are selfless and understand their need for righteousness. So they seek after it. They hunger and thirst for righteousness. Reminds me of the psalmist that says, as a deer pants for the water brook, so pants my soul for you, O Lord. Or early will I seek you, my soul thirsts for you, my flesh longs for you in a dry and thirsty land where there is no water. Those are the people who hunger and thirst for righteousness. And what does the scripture say? It says they will be filled because they seek it from the one who is able to give it. And that is Jesus himself. It reminds me of the parable of that Jesus spoke about the two that went in to pray. You know this parable. It says two went in to pray. One was a Pharisee and the other was a publican. And the Pharisee goes and he looks up to heaven and he says, Father, thank you that I'm not like all the rest of these, especially not like that publican. And he goes on, explains all the things that he's doing for the Lord, right? And it says the publican went in there. He wasn't able to look up into heaven. But he bowed down and he beat his breast. He said, have mercy upon me, a sinner. And Jesus said, which one of these went away righteous? And of course, the obvious answer is the publican went away. Why? Because he sought after hunger and thirst for righteousness. The fifth one is merciful. It says, blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy. Those who are willing to overlook the wrongs done to them, obtaining mercy, they reap what they sow. James chapter 2, verse 13 says, for judgment is without mercy to the one who has shown no mercy. Mercy triumphs over judgment. You see, we need to be merciful. The sixth one is pure in heart. And I'm just skimming over these. I can't get through the whole chapter. I mean, I could make a message out of each one of these, probably. And maybe I'll do that sometime in the future. But in order to get through the text, we have to move along at a rapid speed. And so the sixth one is pure in heart. It says, blessed are those who are pure in heart, for they shall see God. Those who have right motives and a cleansed heart of sin, they will see God. Only those who have a clean heart can stand in the presence of God. Listen to what it says in Psalm 24, verses 3 and 4. Who may ascend into the hill of the Lord, or who may stand in his holy place? He who has clean hands and a pure heart, who has not lifted up his soul to an idol, nor sworn deceitfully. 1 Timothy chapter 1, verse 5 says, Now the purpose of the commandment is love from a pure heart, from a good conscience, and from sincere faith. 2 Timothy 2, verse 22 says, Flee youthful lusts, but pursue righteousness, faith, love, peace, with those who call on the Lord out of a pure heart. And 1 Peter 1, 22, Since you have purified your souls in obeying the truth from the Spirit, in sincere love of the brethren, love one another fervently with a pure heart. You see, God's desire is for us to have a pure heart. One of the problems that the Pharisees had time and time again is they only looked at the external. They were able to conform themselves to certain external characteristics, so people looked at them and said, well, they're righteous, but their heart was far from God. And God would rather have a contrite heart, a pure heart. And then seventhly is peacemakers. It says, Blessed are those who are peacemakers, for they shall be called sons of God. Now, there are two types of peacemakers. There are those who make peace between man and man, and there are those who make an effort to make peace between God and man. And we are to be about the business of being peacemakers in both ways. In other words, we are to be careful that we make peace with one another. We're not supposed to be embattled and enraged all the time. What a great tragedy it is when we see the churches breaking up. Isn't that a sad thing? When churches fall apart because of petty doctrines, usually color of carpets and color of walls, or whether or not to buy a screen or not buy a screen. I mean, that's crazy. And yet churches break up because of that. We're supposed to be peacemakers and to make for peace. But not only that, we are also to be people who call people into peace with God. And the only way that, of course, we can call people into peace with God is that we share the gospel with them, because there is peace in the gospel between God and man. Proverbs chapter 20, verse 3 says, It is honorable for man to stop striving, since any fool can start a quarrel. Now, there is a lot of idea today that would say that they are actually peacemakers, but in reality, they are actually contrary to peacemakers. I think, for example, those who are involved in the tolerance movement. You know what the tolerance movement is? You can say anything you want and believe anything you want as long as you don't impose your views on anybody else. That's what tolerance is. Of course, by saying that, of course, they're being intolerant of those who want to impose their views on other people, but that's beside the issue. And so they say that, well, that's what makes peace, is we have a tolerant society. That's not what makes peace. You know what makes peace? Living by the Scriptures. That's what makes peace. And then I think there's also this idea that in order for us to make peace, we need to impose our will upon other nations. And so our government's involved in all kinds of conflicts overseas, trying to, quote unquote, make peace. And all the while, I think in many cases, what we're doing is we're actually causing hostility in foreign lands. And so we need to be about the business of being peacemakers. And then finally, the last part of it talks about being persecuted. Verse 10, it says, Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Now, let me just take a pause here and say sometimes we're persecuted because we've done wrong. And we claim it's for righteousness' sake, but in reality it's not. I remember when I was growing up, sometimes I would get in trouble at school, believe it or not. And it was always the principal's fault or the teacher's fault or somebody else's fault. It was never my fault, right? And so I was just being persecuted. No, I was just getting in trouble. and I think sometimes that's the way it is. But he says, Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when they revile you and persecute you and say all kinds of evil against you falsely for my sake. Rejoice and be exceedingly glad, for great is your reward in heaven, for so they persecuted the prophets who were before you. Now we're in good company when we're persecuted. It says they persecuted him. They persecuted Christ, and when he came, what did they do? They beat him. They spat upon him. They wanted to kill him. They flogged him. They put him on the cross. That's the kind of company we're in if we're persecuted. And then also it says they persecuted the prophets who were before. We talked about that in Sunday school class this morning. What did they do to the prophets? Some they stoned. Some they killed. Some they left. Some they ignored. And so we're in good company when we are persecuted. And so those are the attributes that we would say call happiness to us. Now, we don't pursue these most of the time, do we? We pursue just the opposite. And yet, if we really want to have a deep and abiding and lasting happiness that comes from God, that's what we need to be pursuing. Those kinds of qualities. These are the qualities that we try to instill in our children. Or at least we should be trying to instill in our children. Too often we're seeking just the opposite. Instead, we must seek these if we're going to be happy. So that's righteousness and happiness. The second division here is righteousness and discipleship. Righteousness and discipleship. We see this in verses 13 through 16. And first of all, he talks about being salt. In verse 13, he says, "You are the salt of the earth, but if the salt loses its flavor, how shall it be seasoned? It is then good for nothing to be thrown out and trampled underfoot by men." Now, salt is used for two reasons primarily, preservative and for flavoring. And in a preservative state, it has to be good salt. Now, most salt stays a long time that we have, whether it be table salt or sea salt or something like that that we get today in our stores. But in the Middle East, particularly in Israel, they would get their salt from the Dead Sea. And it was often contaminated with gypsum, would go bad. And so if they had contaminated salt, it would be good for nothing but be thrown out and trampled underfoot by men. And so that's the reference that is referred to there. But the idea is that we are to be a preservative agent in our society. Salt is also used as a flavoring agent. This is probably the secondary understanding, though. The idea is that we are to be about the business of preserving what is good and right. In all contexts, all contexts in which we find ourselves, whether it be in work or whether it be in the home, or whether it be in society, in politics, whatever it might be, we are to be a preserving element of what is good. That's what salt is. And then also he talks about being light in verses 14 through 16. He says, "You are the light of the world. A city that is set on a hill cannot be hidden, nor do they light a lamp and put it on a basket, but put it on a lampstand that gives light to all who are in the house." So one of the idea behind this is that a light needs to be shining. It's no good for a light not to shine. And so you don't put a lighthouse and cover the lighthouse up. You don't put a lamp on a lampstand and then cover the lampstand up. No, you make it so that it exposes the light. That's the purpose of the light itself. So we must not hide from public view. Now, I know that there are some people who like to be in the forefront and other people like to kind of serve in the background. Both are needed. But we cannot shy away from what God has called us to do in being light. Light often exposes the darkness, doesn't it? I remember one time in a house that I lived in, there were all kinds of cockroaches in the garage at night. But if you go out during the day, you turn on a light, not a cockroach to be seen. And one time I went out in the morning, I went to go exercise, and it was still dark, and I had my exercise bike out there. And I opened up the door, and I turned on the light, and the whole ground just of cockroaches. I know it's kind of gross, but that's what light does. It exposes the darkness. Why is it that most bad things happen at night? Because it happens in the dark. You've always heard, never walk down a dark alley at night, right? Because that's where bad things happen. It's in the dark. And so instead, as Christians, what we need to be involved in is we need to be involved in exposing the light, or exposing the darkness with our light. And the way that we do that, of course, is with the scriptures. That's what gives light to man. So verse 16, "Let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and glorify your Father in heaven." It reminds me of the passage that says, always have a reason for the hope that you have within you. In other words, if we're living a life of godliness, if we're living a life of being light to the world, there are going to be people who are attracted to that light. We are also going to be people who expose danger. Just like a lighthouse is on the edge of the rocks, so that as the ships go by, they're able to see where the cliffs are and where the rocks are, so that they avoid those things. That's what we are as Christians. We're to be people who preach the good news of avoiding the rocks, avoiding the danger. And so we are to be light. And so my question is, how salty are you? How much light do you bring off? Has your light gone dim? Has your saltiness lost its flavor? I pray that it hasn't. I pray instead that we might be followers of Christ, disciples of Him, exposing the darkness and preserving what is good. The third division here is righteousness and the scriptures. Righteousness and the scriptures. We see this in verses 17 through 20. 17 through 20. And I think it's interesting to note that the Pharisees had this view of the scriptures that was in some ways good and some ways bad. And they had this understanding that the law was to be kept to the T. And they had actually, I think, 613 different laws that you had to follow in the Old Testament if you're going to be righteous. And then Jesus comes on the scene, and he actually goes a little bit beyond what they are explaining by going to the heart of the issue. But first, before he does that, what he does is he explains that he is the fulfillment. He is the embodiment of that very righteousness in the law that they are looking for. Look with me in verse 17, it says, "Do not think that I have come to destroy the law or the prophets." He's about ready to explain a little bit different understanding of the law than what they had been accustomed to, what they had learned. And so he's saying, don't think that I've come here to do away with the law of the scriptures. I've not come to do away with it. But instead he says, "I did not come to destroy, but to fulfill the law." And indeed, Jesus did fulfill the law. He fulfills it by living up to every command perfectly and completely. He fulfills the moral law by living completely holy, without sin, and obedient to it. He fulfills the ceremonial law by being the real thing to which the shadow is pointed. He fulfills the judicial law by personifying God's perfect righteousness and justice. And so in verse 18 it says, "For assuredly I say to you, till heaven and earth pass away, one jot or one tittle will by no means pass from the law till all is fulfilled." That, now the jot and the tittle there are just little marks in the Hebrew writing. It might be like what we say, every I dotted and every T crossed. That's basically what he's saying. He's saying, look, everything will be completely fulfilled. There won't be an I that's not dotted and there won't be a T that's not crossed in the law till all is fulfilled. And he's fulfilling every little bit of it with his life. And then verse 19, "Whoever therefore breaks one of the least of these commandments and teaches men so shall be called least in the kingdom of heaven. But whoever does not, whoever does and teaches them shall be called great in the kingdom of heaven. For I say to you that unless your righteousness exceeds the righteousness of the scribes and the Pharisees, you will by no means enter the kingdom of heaven." I believe in verse 19 what he's talking about there is he's talking about those who are followers of Christ and those who are not. Those who are the goats and those who are the sheep. Those who are outside the faith and those who are inside the faith. And he is describing that very carefully. And then verse 20, he talks about the righteousness exceeding the righteousness of the scribes and the Pharisees. Now before we give a bad rap to the Pharisees, we have to give them a little bit of credit. They were actually started to try to restore Israel to the law. They were people who had a heart for God to begin with. And yet because over generation, over generation, over generation, they had become more and more familiar and more demanding of man-made laws than they were of God's laws, they became distorted on that. But even at the New Testament times, many of the things that they were doing were good things. They were just doing them with the wrong heart. They had developed a system of rituals or rules that could be followed on the outside, even if it did not produce righteousness, because on the inside they were far from it. And so in Matthew chapter 23, verse 23, it says this, "Woe to you scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you pay tithe of mint and anise and cumin, and have neglected the weightier matters of law." So here they were so diligent about paying their tithe that if they had an herb garden, they would take 10% of their herbs and then produce that and give that away as part of their tithe. That's saying a lot, isn't it? I mean, according to average statistics, Southern Baptists give about 4% of their income. So here we have the Pharisees giving far more than that. So that's a good thing, right? But he calls them hypocrites. Why? Because they were more focused on the outward and not the inward. And so he says, "You have neglected the weightier matters of the law, justice and mercy and faith. These you ought to have done without leaving the others undone." So he doesn't condemn them for tithing, but he does condemn them for not focusing on the weightier matters of the law. And so he says here, "Assuredly I say to you, will by no means get," or I'm sorry, in verse 20, "For I say to you, unless your righteousness exceeds the righteousness of the scribes and the Pharisees, you will by no means enter the kingdom of heaven." Well, that's hard words, isn't it? Unless we're being even more diligent about tithing every 10%, even from our herb garden. You produce a garden in the summertime, you produce some tomatoes, you got to sell 10% of them and give that money to the church. That's what he's saying here. But beyond that, we've also got to be able to be even more diligent than that by having a heart that's right. So what's his point? His point is we can't keep the law. That's his point. His point is we can't be more righteous than the Pharisees. It's impossible. And he goes on and explains that even in more detail as we get into the next section. And so in verses 5, or chapter 5, verses 21 through 48, we see righteousness and morality. And here what he does is he goes a little bit deeper into the whole idea of the law. And he says, this is what the law says, but it goes even deeper than that. And so in verse 21, it says, "You have heard that it was said to those of old, you shall not murder." That's, of course, it's quoting from the Ten Commandments. "You shall not murder. And whoever murders will be in danger of the judgment." All the Pharisees believe that. All the people in the New Testament believe that. And so he's saying, this is what you believe. You believe that if you murder, you'll be in danger of judgment. That is true. But then he goes on. He says, but I say to you that whoever is angry with his brother without a cause shall be in danger of judgment. And whoever says to his brother, Raca, that basically could mean, you know, a type of fool or idiot or something like that, shall be in danger of the council. But whoever says, you fool, shall be in danger of the hellfire. Well, that's a lot harder, isn't it? You see, did you know that when we speak unkind words to someone else, in our heart we're murdering them? The Lord looks at it as murder in the heart. Now, how many times have we spoken unkind words to somebody? I know what we can think, well, I've never really been that bad. I've never really killed anybody. Really? According to the standards of God? You ever been angry? Called somebody an idiot? Scriptures tell us it's murder in the heart. Holding a grudge. Angry with someone who's treated you badly. Hate speech. You know, there's all kinds of thought going around to whether or not if somebody murders somebody that they were opposed to for, you know, sexual reasons or something like that, homosexuality or something, it's considered hate speech. And so they've got, you know, more problems than just the murderer and all this kind of thing. Well, you know, whether we want to regulate that or not, God understands that. God knows our heart. And he regulates that in his own way. And so murder extends to the intentions of the heart. Also, look with me in verse 23. It says, therefore, if you bring your gift to the altar and there remember that your brother has something against you, leave your gift there before the altar. Go your way. First be reconciled to your brother and then come and offer your gift. How many of us, I know this has never happened in your family, but it has happened in mine. You're on your way to church, right? And things didn't go right in preparation for church. Maybe the kids didn't want to wear the right clothing, or you know, you're running late and you forget a few things. And so as you're leaving the door, you're angry with each other and you're fuming, and you know, husband's not talking to the wife, wife's not talking to the husband, and the kids are mad and angry. And you get to church and what happens? Everything is great. How you? Oh, I'm doing fine. Thank you. Great day, isn't it? Great being in the house of the Lord, right? Don't we do that? God knows our heart. And so what does he say? He says, if you bring your gift to the altar and there remember you have brother something against you, leave your gift at the altar, go your way. First be reconciled to your brother and then come here. We can't worship the Lord when we've got anger in our heart like that. And so we are to repent of that and turn away from that first. Verse 25, agree with your adversary quickly while you're on your way with him. Let your adversary deliver you to judge. The judge hand you over to the officer. You'll be thrown into prison. Assuredly, I say to you, you will not get out of there until you pay the last penny. And so the idea behind this, of course, is that murder begins in the heart. And we must turn away from those actions, those attitudes in our heart that would be murderous by our actions. And then secondly, we see in verses 27 through 30, we see that adultery extends to the attitude of the heart as well. Look with me at verse 27. It says, you have heard that it was said to those of old, you shall not commit adultery. Again, another one of the commandments, right? Ten commandments. Shall not commit adultery. We all say, well, we can't do that, right? That's wrong. Well, this is what it says in verse 28. But I say to you that whoever looks at a woman to lust for her has already committed adultery with her in his heart. Whew. That's a tough one, isn't it? Now, I don't know how women deal with this, but this is a struggle for men. I think since day one, well, maybe not day one, but maybe day 12, year 12, guys struggle with this. And we say, well, we're not committing adultery, right? In the heart we are, as the scriptures say. But I say to you, whoever looks at a woman to lust for her has already committed adultery with her in his heart. If your right eye causes you to sin, pluck it out and cast it from you. It is more profitable that one of your members perish than for your whole body to be thrown into hell. If your right hand causes you to sin, cut it off and cast it from you. It is more profitable that one of your members perish than for your whole body to be cast into hell. Now he's not here advocating self-mutilation. I don't believe that's what he's saying. But I believe what he is saying is that we need to take this thing seriously. This is a real issue. We can't just let it slide off. Some of the jokes people make about watching TV and cheerleaders and the sports games and Victoria's Secrets catalogs, and not to mention pornography and everything else. I mean, that's sin. And then he goes on in verses 31 and 32, talking about divorce. Furthermore, it has been said, whoever divorces his wife, let him give her a certificate of divorce. But I say to you that whoever divorces his wife for any reason except sexual or immorality causes her to commit adultery. And whoever marries a woman who is divorced commits adultery. Now this slams in the face of what our culture says. And, you know, today in our culture, you can get a no-fault divorce, can't you? You can go down to the courthouse and say, we're no longer compatible, or we're no longer in love. And the divorce attorneys will give you the paperwork like that. That's not what the Bible says. In fact, the Bible says that there are really only two possible conditions for divorce. One is persistent porneia, which is the word that's given here, persistent adultery. And the other is listed in 1 Corinthians chapter 7, which is where you're abandoned because of your faith. Where someone says, you know what, you became a Christian, I don't want to live with a Christian anymore, I'm out of here. That would be the only other option in the scriptures. And some would even say that the clause that he's given here refers to that period of time where there was a betrothal. Where if one was found unfaithful during that period of time, betrothal, that the other one was to be able to give the certificate of divorce away, and they were to no longer have that period of betrothal and anticipation of marriage. And so it might be even more strict than what I'm saying. But what is the bottom line? The bottom line is, this is a serious thing. And yet in our culture, we just brush it off, no big deal. And then we look in verses 33 through 37 and talks about oaths. It says, again, you have heard that it was said to those of old, you shall not swear falsely, but shall perform your oaths to the Lord. This is, of course, dealing with bearing false witness, speaking untruths. He says, but I say to you, do not swear at all. I don't think he's telling us that if we go to court and we're asked to give a solemn oath and swear upon the Bible that we're not supposed to do that. There are some who interpret that way, but I don't believe he's saying that. What I think he's getting to the heart of the issue. What is the heart of the issue here? He says, neither by heaven nor by its throne, neither by the earth, nor shall you swear by the head, verse 36, but let your yes be yes and your no, no, for whatever is more than these is of the evil one. So what's his point? His point is that we are to speak truthfully no matter what. How many of us growing up always had this phrase saying, no, no, I cross my heart and hope to die. You ever said that growing up or heard kids say that? What are they doing? They're trying to say, no, no, this is, I really mean this. As though the rest of the time they're not really meaning it. Or how many of us have ever said, no, no, I'm serious. I know one of my boys does that all the time. No, seriously. So the rest of the time you're not serious? Or how many of us say, no, 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 I'm not kidding. Or, no, I'm not lying. Does that mean the rest of the time that you are kidding, the rest of the time you are lying? No, what's the point here? The point is, we are to speak the truth always. That our words should mean something. Now, what does that mean in everyday life? How many of us have ever said, no, I'll be there at 6 o'clock. And we get there at 6:30. We have just violated this command, haven't we? Or how many of us have promised our kids something, promised our grandkids something, and then we don't come through? How many of us have promised the pastor something? Well, I'm going to be there on Sunday, pastor. And nowhere to be found. It's a violation of this command, isn't it? How many of us have made wedding vows and then don't keep them? How many of us have done this before? Well, I'm going to pray for you. And you forget. And you don't pray for the person. It's a violation of this command. Broken promises to God. How many of us have said, God, if you get me out of this situation, I'm going to do... fill in the blank. God gets us out of the situation. What do? Forget about it. It's a violation of what he's saying here. How many of us have made church covenants, broken those covenants? The idea is that our word should be rock solid. When we say we're going to do something, we should do it. I mean, just recently, I made the mistake of saying I was going to be at a friend's house to help him milk. And forgot. We do it all the time, don't we? So what is the point? The point is, we can't live to the standards of God. All of us fall short of the requirements that he has for us. And then verses 38 through 42, we see retaliation. You have heard that it was said to those of old, an eye for an eye, and a tooth for a tooth. This, by the way, was an Old Testament requirement that was designed to prohibit excessive punishment for the crime. In other words, so if someone takes a toy from somebody, you can't go kill the person. And that's excessive judgment, right? And so the idea is eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. And they had followed that for the most part. But listen to what Jesus says. He says, "But I say to you, resist not the evil person. But whoever slaps you on your right cheek, turn to him the other also. If anyone wants to sue you, take away your tunic, give him your cloak also." Whoa, that's... Can you imagine practicing that in the courts? Someone sues you because you, didn't pay your mortgage payment. So the company sues you and they go there and say, "You're foreclosing on it now." And you say, "Okay, it's yours. Not only that, you can have my car too." They'd look and say, what? You crazy? Now, I'm not advocating necessarily doing that, okay? What his point is, we need to take these things seriously. His point is that we need to be radical about our faith. And so radical that we can't do it. That's his whole point, is that we need a Savior. Eye for an eye, resist an evil person. We can't get back through manipulation, get back through the silent treatment, get back by intentionally being mean to someone, getting back by taking justice into our own hands. That's what it's talking about here. And then verses 43 through the end of the chapter, we see love is extended to even the unlovable. Verse 43, it says, "You have heard that it was said to those of old, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy." Now he's combining two different phrases here. One, of course, is to love. That's in Deuteronomy chapter 6, which says love your neighbor. The hate your enemy is a collection of some other ideas that are found in the scriptures in the Old Testament. It's not necessarily what he had commanded. Verse 44, "But I say to you, love your enemies. Bless those who curse you. Do good to those who hate you. And pray for those who spitefully use you and persecute you." Now, is that hard to do? It is really hard to do. Our natural inclination is when someone does us wrong, what do we want to do? We want to do them wrong. Those who are opposed to us. Can you imagine being persecuted? We talk about the persecuted Christians. We pray for them. There are some on our prayer list. Every week we have a nation that we focus on that is being persecuted. You read some of the things that are taking place in those lands. People's property being stolen. People being beaten. Put into prison. Withheld food. Tortured. And we're supposed to pray for those people that are doing that? We're supposed to bless them? We're supposed to love them? You see, it's really easy. That's what he says. He says, "For if you love those who love you, what reward have you? Do not even the tax collectors do that?" In other words, it's really easy to love somebody who loves you, isn't it? I mean, that's natural. That's what's normal. He's not asking us to love naturally or normally. He's asking us to love supernaturally. He's asking us to love those who are hard to love. Love the unlovable. Verse 47. "And if you greet your brethren only, what do you do more than the others? Do not even the tax collectors do that? Therefore you shall be perfect, just as your Father in heaven is perfect." That gets to the heart of the issue, doesn't it? Well, what is he asking us to do and to be in this chapter, as well as the rest of the Sermon on the Mount? He's asking us to be perfect. And so what is he asking us to do? He's asking us to call upon him for mercy, because we know that we can't be perfect. There's not a person here who could say, "Yep, I've done all that in chapter 5. Done. Check it off." No way. It's not possible. And so he's asking for us to plead to him for mercy. So what do we make of all this? What should we do? How should we understand this? All the religions of the world say do this, do that, and you can achieve righteousness. That's not what the Bible says. The Bible says it can't be done. He says that Jesus already did it. That the act of righteousness is already done by Jesus on the cross. And so because of our faith in him, now as an act of gratitude, we respond by doing certain things. But we can't do anything to achieve righteousness. Only he is able to be the righteous one for us. All have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. If you're not yet under conviction from chapter 5, your heart's probably hard. Stay tuned for chapter 6 and 7. It's just as hard hitting. Humble ourselves before God. It's clear from this passage that there's no room for pride. We can't say, yeah, well, I've kept that commandment. No, sir. Not according to the standards of God. Not when he looks at our heart. Maybe externally we've not killed anybody. But I know we've been angry. And that's the same thing in God's eyes. So we must humble ourselves before him. And then we must plead for his mercy. That's our only hope, is the mercy of God. And then finally, live in gratitude for what he has done for us and establish and fulfilling righteousness for us. We must live our lives with gratitude, knowing that we can never even begin to take a step in the right direction for God. It's only because he has entered into our life. It's only because he has laid down his perfect life. It's only because he has lived perfectly and righteously and then laid down his life on the cross that we can even begin to take our next breath. All mercy for God. Behind, and that should move us.
Time after time is a legacy with nothing to show. Now our country is lost, and it's not without cost, for there's many who struggle every day. And I think that it's time we start crying for our nation and bow our heads and pray. If today you lost your life, what would you leave behind? What would the ones around you see? What happened in the dash between your birth and death? What will you do to change your legacy? Just like the plant that withers away, we will leave many seeds behind. If today you lost your life, what would you leave behind? What would the ones around you see? What happened in the dash between your birth and death? What will you do to change your legacy? Change your legacy. What will you do to change your legacy?